So I want to welcome you all to our event this evening. I'm the president of the Independent Institute, and as some of you may know, we hold events such as this as part of a series called the Independent Policy Forum. We hold the forum events as lectures, seminars, and debates on a regular basis here at our offices in Oakland. We also do a series at our offices in Washington, D.C. Our program today is, as I'm sure you all know, especially timely and momentous with the U.S. Supreme Court's recent landmark case in District of Columbia versus Heller, in which the court ruled that the Second Amendment is an individual right to privately keep and bear arms. Our event tonight is entitled, What the Second Amendment Means Today. So it certainly could not be more timely, as I mentioned. And we're quite pleased and privileged to have two speakers with us who have been two of the really renowned and key legal scholars who have worked in this field for literally decades. These two gentlemen are really two of the real lions of knowledge and dedication to this field. In fact, it really cannot be overstated how important the work of these two men has been in this historic case, but more about that as we proceed. As you may know, the Independent Institute is a public policy research institute. We have about 140 research fellows. We are an academic research institute. As a result, we publish many studies as books, such as the one we're featuring tonight. We also publish a journal called The Independent Review. This is a recent issue. It's a quarterly that is edited by the scholar Robert Higgs, and I would commend that to you. There's information in your packets about many of our books as well as the journal. You'll also find information about how to become a member at the Institute and the benefits of doing that as far as discounts to books and events and other things. We also have a weekly email newsletter, which you're welcome to receive, called The Lighthouse, and we report on many new current affairs by many of our fellows and also upcoming programs. One upcoming event I wanted to point out, there's a one-page sheet in your packets about the summer seminars that we hold, and these are for high school and college students, and these are one-week seminars in which students receive a sound, in-depth understanding of economics, history, political theory, and so forth, and to equip them to have a worldview that we believe is critical to really make sense of the world as well as to be successful in their own lives. And the worldview is a combination of ethics and economics and related topics. We started this years ago because of the concern that we have about the rampant political correctness in so many schools and colleges. And I'm not sure if you've heard about the recent study. There's a group called the Intercollegiate Studies Institute that has been doing a number of studies of the knowledge that undergraduates have in the United States, and they've done the most extensive survey ever done over a number of years. And the results of that have recently been released, and believe it or not, the result shows that the plurality of graduating seniors at most major schools, colleges, actually score less than entering freshmen on basic civic knowledge. So those of you interested in this, Carl Close, who's in the back, standing, my colleague, would be happy to answer any questions, and I would too as well. So we hope that if you know students, either as children or friends or students who are here this evening, that you look into that. By the way, the dates for that, I should mention, is August 11th to 15th. Last year, a federal appeals court, as I think you all know, overturned the District of Columbia's ban on handguns. Now, of course, the court has determined that that was unconstitutional after nearly 70 years of silence on the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment has been clearly and remains in many intellectual circles the most controversial and least understood rights in the U.S. Constitution. Did the founders intend to safeguard an individual right, as the court has ruled, or a so-called collective right? And there are many stories that many of us can relate to you, and I'm sure many of you have similar stories of the dismissive view that many circles have had about people who would make the argument that it is an individual right. What kinds of gun restrictions, if any, are consistent with the founders' aims? How exactly has gun ownership and gun control in the United States and elsewhere affected violent crime rates? Why did the founders adopt the Second Amendment? What was the motivation? What was their thinking? Our first speaker tonight is going to address the issue, the issues really primarily that were in the case, based on his new book, which most of you know about, called The Founders' Second Amendment, which has just recently come out, but we were able to get proofs of it into circulation among those who were considering the arguments for the case, and many of the scholars who are in this field have been aware of our speaker's work for numerous years. He worked on this book for what, 10 years? Is that?
Well, it goes back to like the 60s. I
mean. Yeah, it's been a while. So, Dr. Halbrook also, I should mention, filed the amicus brief for the case on behalf of 55 members of the Senate president, and 250 members of the House of Representatives in the case. So his involvement has been ranging from scholarship to direct involvement in the issues in the court and public policy arenas. He received his JD from Georgetown University Law Center. He received his PhD in social philosophy from Florida State University. He's taught legal and political philosophy at George Mason University, Howard University, and Tuskegee Institute. He's the winner of three cases before the Supreme Court dealing with gun issues. He's testified before many House and Senate committees. In addition to the Founder's Second Amendment, he's the author of many other books, author and editor of other books. Some of you may be familiar with another book that we published called That Every Man Be Armed, Evolution of a Constitutional Right. He's also the his books also include A Right to Bear Arms, The Firearms Law Desk Book, Freedmen, The 14th Amendment and the Right to Bear Arms, 1866 to 1876, which is a very important book on how blacks were disarmed after the Civil War. His also books include State and Federal Bills of Right and Constitutional Guarantees, and the very notable book on the Swiss resistance to the Nazis called Target Switzerland. So I'm very pleased to introduce Steve Halbrook.
Thank you, David. Just to begin with, I want to pay very brief tribute to three people, and one of them is David Thoreau. He was very actively involved in getting a publisher for the book and seeking out various publishers and also working with me in terms of planning to do the book. There's only one chapter in That Every Man Be Armed, my first book on the subject, that deals with the Constitution period, the American Revolution and the Constitution period, but there's always been so much more information I've encountered over the years, and so it was time to do a whole book on the founding period only. So thank you, David, for all your encouragement. My wife, Brenda, is she here? There she is. You know, when it, every time I do a book, she's like another one, you know. So thank you for your patience. And then there's Don Cates, my old friend. I met him in 1976. And Don's a legend in his own time. He's really done a lot on this issue, worked tirelessly. And, you know, some of us, Don and myself and a few others, we do this almost, I guess, full time for decades. And it's like when we started doing it, academics would say, you're a bunch of quacks, and the judges in most federal courts would say things like, well, that's frivolous, and now we really got them good. I mean, this is real revenge. Don's essay published in Michigan Law Review back in the early 80s is cited more than once in the Supreme Court's decision. My book, Freedman, the 14th Amendment and the Right to Bear Arms, is cited in a very important part of the Heller opinion for one purpose, because now we're going after states and localities that restrict firearm ownership or prohibit handguns. And as you know, probably have heard, we filed lawsuits in Chicago, Morton Grove, and also the public housing lawsuit in San Francisco here. And that deals with, if I can regress just a little bit, with incorporation, whether the Second Amendment's incorporated into the 14th Amendment so that it limits state action. And so I'm going to kind of, like, it's like the past is prologue. I was here a lot in the early 90s in California because you had the distinction of the Roberti Ruse Law, the first so-called assault weapon ban in human history in the Americas. And we fought that tooth and nail, and we did not prevail. But the same authorities we brought to the U.S. Court of Appeals to the Ninth Circuit's attention were things like that were cited now in the Heller opinion. There's an analysis of the 14th Amendment issue. For example, the Freedmen's Bureau Act of 1866, two-thirds of Congress declared that the rights to personal security and personal liberty include the constitutional right to bear arms. And the same two-thirds of Congress that enacted that passed the 14th Amendment out of the Congress. And we briefed all that back in the early 90s before your Ninth Circuit. And what did they do in the opinion? They completely ignore all of this. And they held that California doesn't have to recognize the Second Amendment. They can ban anything they want to ban. And so it's all come full circle now because it's in the majority opinion by Justice Scalia. Not only does the Second Amendment protect individual rights, but hello, states and localities, it applies where you are as well as to the District of Columbia. Now, the court didn't make that finding because D.C. is not a state or a locality, but it's very clear in the opinion that that looks like where the court is headed. And if you're a federal judge and you read that and you're a lower court federal judge, you ought to really pay attention. So these are going to be issues that are coming up in the very near future here and in Chicagoland. Look for the action. You know, the decision only came down like last Thursday, right? And it's been like 3 months or something because we've had to prepare new lawsuits and then the Independent Institute through Wendy signs me up for all these interviews, and I have no time, and I'm supposed to be reading the opinion, too. Like, it's hard to – the opinion's 120 pages if you add the dissents to it. So it's been quite a ride. But it's a real pleasure to be here. I want to talk about the book a little bit, and I want to talk about the Heller opinion a little bit and try to stay within the time guidelines, and we will be – answering questions at the end of this session. But if you go back to litigation on this issue, those of us like Don and myself and others, Don Kilmer's here, he's done this issue in your state. First, there was the pre-Emerson period. All federal circuits in the country basically that said anything about the Second Amendment had nothing good to say about it. And they endorsed the so-called collective rights view, which tries to say that the right of the people to keep and bear arms means that the states have a power to maintain militias. So that's a curious way of saying that. And in fact, in the oral argument in March, Chief Justice Roberts asked counsel for the District of Columbia, isn't it a little bit of a curious way to say that the states can maintain militias if they say the people have a right to keep and bear arms? And so you can imagine the attempt to try to catch up and make a response to that. Then in 2001, just a few days after 9/11 hit, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit in the Emerson case held that the Second Amendment protects individual rights. And it was the first decent opinion on the Second Amendment by the federal judiciary in its entire history. It's many, many pages that go into the text of the amendment, the intent of the framers, and the early cases that construed it, particularly at the state level, and on up through modern times. Now, after a lot of the scholarship had been set forth in the 80s and 90s, the so-called sophisticated collective rights view was invented, which held that, okay, in other words, this anti-Second Amendment people would say, this is not just a state power to maintain a militia, but it's a personal individual right to bear arms in the militia. Now, if you think about the absurdity of that, to be in the militia, you have to be conscripted, basically. I mean, there were independent militia companies in the pre-revolutionary period, but basically the militia is a military institution, it's a command society, a command-type organization. And the absurdity of saying that you have a right to bear arms if you're in the militia, it's like, first of all, if a government tells you to be in the militia, are you worried that same government will deprive you of arms and not let you do what that government wants you to do? So if they want you to bear arms and bear arms against an enemy, you have a right to do it. So if the government tells you you can't do it, I mean, where is this headed anyway? You can file a lawsuit. And also, besides not having a right to even be in a militia, what do you have a right to do when you're in the military? Like what they tell you, right? So if they tell you to peel potatoes and you say, no, I want to carry a Smith & Wesson Model 29 around and do whatever, I mean, it's mind-boggling. And yet the dissent, four justices adopted that view in the Heller decision. The dissent written by Justice Stevens was joined in by the other three justices, and that would be Souter and Ginsburg and Breyer. And can you imagine a case being filed in court that would seek to enforce such a right to bear arms in the militia? They wouldn't obviously be ones to abide by that or to agree with that. And when you also look at the less sophisticated states' rights view of the Second Amendment, the people who don't like the Second Amendment usually don't like so-called states' rights. And so suddenly we have these anti-federalism people champion the right of states to maintain militias. That doesn't make any sense. So in any event, after the Emerson case came down, then we had some other federal courts making snide remarks about that decision, even though none of their circuits had ever done anything respectful. But I don't remember the exact year, but about 3 or 4 years later, the Ninth Circuit got revenge, and that was in the Silvera case, where Judge Reinhardt authored the opinion saying that the Second Amendment was a collective militia right, and he used that case that was brought before the court as an opportunity to write a really long opinion that he thought rebutted the Emerson case. So it was basically a polemic against Emerson. And there things stood until a year ago in March, and I was at the Iwa show in Germany having a good time looking at guns, and I got this phone call, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit held that the D.C. gun law was invalid. I mean, that was quite an electrifying moment, because in the Emerson case, there was no law invalidated. The court upheld the federal law against the possession of a gun while being under a restraining order against domestic violence. So here you had the first federal court of appeals to actually invalidate a law. And I had worked on the same issue in a parallel case, and that case went out on standing grounds. And so we had this decision, and then a lot of planning took place in between a year ago in March and the briefs being filed and preparation for oral argument. And finally, it ends up this March, we had the oral argument. Let me mention just a few things about that. I told you what Chief Justice Roberts said early on in the argument, that isn't this kind of a curious way, if you say the right of the people, a curious way of protecting some governmental power? One of my favorite parts was the Walter Dellinger, counsel for D.C., was talking about how easy it is to remove a trigger lock, because that's another part of the issue in the D.C. case was the invalidation of the requirement that all guns always be kept without any ammunition loaded and either disassembled or trigger locked. And there was no exemption even for self-defense. And so Mr. Dellinger said, well, I did an experiment. I put a trigger lock, or I bought a trigger lock, and I was able to work the combination and to release it in 2 seconds. And Chief Justice Roberts kind of leaned forward and said, well, what if it was in the middle of the night and you're waking up and trying to find the lamp and trying to find your reading glasses? And he didn't say it, but, I mean, your hands are shaking and you don't know what's going on. So that didn't carry much water. The court did invalidate that requirement as well, the aspect of the D.C. law that you can never use your gun for self-defense because you're never allowed to load it or take the trigger lock off. Justice Breyer at the oral argument did the same thing he did in his dissenting opinion in this case, basically talk about, well, statistics can be shown that the D.C. law helped decrease the murder rate, and the D.C. Council, we should defer to them, and they're a legislative body, and we're against judicial activism. This is Breyer, you know. And, of course, the fact is D.C. has been the murder capital of the country for most of the year since the D.C. law was enacted. And one of my favorite arguments, there's this really sophisticated study by physicians, I believe it was, and they said, well, the very first year after the D.C. law went into effect, the murder rate went down. Well, guess what? There was an injunction against enforcement of the law that first year because gun owners went to court and got that injunction. So that didn't prove anything. But in any case, the oral argument was really fun and games. We were there I was there with fellow attorneys in the attorney section of the Supreme Court listening to the argument, and we all knew that this was going to come down to Justice Kennedy, right? He's the swing vote. And we're sitting there, and like Kennedy opens his mouth, and like, what is he going to say? He asked the D.C. attorney, the founders were settlers of this country, right? Didn't they have to have guns for defending themselves against criminals, from hostile Indians, and against grizzly bears? And we're thinking, hey, Kennedy's on our side. Because that showed he agreed with the individual rights view, even though he didn't know there were no grizzly bears in the East. It's okay. He's from California. No problem. We forgive him. He voted our way. Thank you, Justice Kennedy. Justice Scalia was his usual self at the argument. I mean, he's always a real pleasure to watch operate and... he can be sarcastic. He can create a lot of laughter, but he wrote the opinion. I was in court last Thursday when he read the opinion, a summary of the opinion orally, and he went in very great detail to explain it. And Justice Stevens went in very great detail to complain about that decision and to say why he thought that he was correct. It rendered on the last day, and in fact, it was the last opinion released of the term. Showing it was the most controversial. Now, an interesting thing, I better talk about the book a little bit because there's a lot in the book that's not in the opinion. Justice Scalia does mostly a textual analysis and then a linguistic analysis of the text. How were the terms keep and bear arms used in those days and in the century before and also in the decades after the Second Amendment was adopted? And he has very little reference to, excuse me, the encroachments of the crown that led to the adoption of the Second Amendment, and very little about any of the debates that took place. Because he doesn't like legislative history, he does like textual linguistic kind of analysis. So that's mostly what the opinion is. He goes through maybe 50 pages of that, and then the last few pages he talks about why the D.C. ban is invalid, and he talks about the fallacies in the opinions by Justices Stevens and Breyer. Excuse me. The book starts in 1768. The Redcoats are sailing to Boston to occupy the town. A patriot writes an editorial in the Boston Gazette, which was the leading Patriot newspaper, probably authored by Samuel Adams or someone like that. And it said that three things are going to happen that are basically worse than anything that has happened before by the British. The first thing is that the inhabitants are going to be disarmed. The second thing is that Patriots would be seized by the British. And then thirdly, they would be taken and tried in England without a jury of their peers. And that's pretty interesting when you think about the taxation issues that preceded that, that they said these were the three worst things that could happen. The British did occupy Boston. It led eventually to the Boston Massacre. The events keep spiraling, the Boston Tea Party. A lot of the things I have in the book are diaries and letters that were private at the time and that have never really been used in any modern history of this issue. You couldn't buy a handgun in Boston in the weeks leading up to the Tea Party. Everybody knew something was going to happen, and there was a diary I found where a gentleman said that all the handguns were bought up. I mean, that is sort of like after the Rodney King thing, right? Or I mean, people buy guns when they really think they need them. But anyway, in those years, you have an escalation of infringements on the right to keep and bear arms. And how did that take place? For one thing, you have the Crown in England banned export of firearms and ammunition into the colonies and also banned the import of those articles here because there was also a lot of trade between the Dutch and the Americans and others who were ended up smuggling arms here. So you interfere with the importation. We have that in the Federal Gun Control Act today. Only so-called sporting arms can be imported. And in fact, one spinoff of the California assault weapon ban and the things that it led to was the ban on importation of semi-automatic rifles, which is a ban imposed by the first Bush administration and administered by the ATF. So that took place. And then as the squeeze kept increasing, you had General Gage appointed as the governor of Massachusetts and also the commander-in-chief of all British forces in the Americas. And in those days, you had, when large quantities of gunpowder had been imported, they would be stored in powder magazines. Black powder was volatile and had a much greater danger of fire. So there were some restrictions on how many pounds of powder a merchant could have, for example. So it would, when the merchants would go to the powder magazine to try to draw supplies of powder out for resale, Gage would not allow the powder magazine keeper to let them have any. And there were periods when it was very difficult to get gunpowder. And as you get towards 1775, when the events start really escalating, it became very, very difficult. And you start seeing recipes for making gunpowder and then published in newspapers. It's one of these don't try this at home things. They didn't say that. They were encouraging it, but it really is dangerous to try to make your own. So eventually we come to the point of searches and seizures of persons and of wagons, for example, going in and out of Boston and firearms being seized. And to show you how legalistically minded people still were at that point, this was early 1775, persons who had guns seized from them by British soldiers thought about filing a criminal complaint for robbery in the courts because there was no legal basis for seizing them. And then there was a merchant who had distributed large quantities of gunpowder for several months on end, and one of his wagon supply trains had been seized by the British. And he actually went in to see General Gage and said, "I want my powder back." And there's an affidavit that he prepared. I mean, this guy really had some gall to go in and do that. But that was the type of people we had in this country. That's the way the Patriots were. You also had entrapment. There was one poor fellow from the country who was in Boston, and according to his account, some soldiers approached him wanting him to buy a gun from them, and he said no and tried to get rid of them, but they prevailed, and you know how entrapment usually goes. They keep bugging you until you do it. But the soldier testified that this guy was trying to buy guns from any soldiers who would sell them. So who do you believe, by the way? Well, it could have been either one. I mean, you know, the Americans were trying to get as many muskets as they could. And so if you were in that situation and the Crown had deprived you of any ability to buy them, if you could buy some from the soldiers, great. But anyway, so the soldiers set upon him and tarred and feathered him. It led to outrage in the colonies, and Thomas Ditson was his name. I don't think his name's been mentioned since 1775, except in my book. But it was another bone of contention that made a lot of people mad. It even made General Gage mad, because that was not the kind of soldierly discipline that he stood for. But April of 75 came around, and he was sent the soldiers out to Lexington and Concord to seize the arms that they knew were stored out there in houses and in farms, barns, and so forth. And they got beat, particularly at Concord. The British are fleeing back to Boston, and a British sergeant did a diary which has some really neat details, like about how the Americans were shooting at them from behind barriers, and they were using goose guns, he said, and other sporting firearms, because they were using their own guns and using whatever they had. The big story that's not known about that era was after Lexington Concord, General Gage told people in Boston, decreed that guns had to be turned in, and if they did turn in all their guns, they would be able to leave Boston. Nobody wanted to be there anymore. It was occupied by the soldiers. Food was getting scarce. And so the appointed day came, and the people turned in their guns, supposedly all of them. They probably kept the best ones. It's like when they have the buybacks, you know, if you have any junk, you turn it in. But a lot of people probably did turn in all their guns, because they really wanted to leave Boston, and they were being searched before they could leave. And they turned it in to Faneuil Hall, which is still there. It's a big meeting place. And their names were carefully recorded, and so they could get their guns back later. And at the end of the day, the Redcoats came and seized all the guns and took them away and never gave any back. And then Gage reneged and wouldn't let people leave Boston. So this was cited in the Declaration of Causes of Taking Up Arms of 1775 by the Continental Congress as one of the great injustices that justified war against the crown. That's just some detail to show you how this right, the motivation for this right to be adopted in the Second Amendment. And there's a lot more like that in the book. It's, if you like action movies, the first third of the book has a lot of that in it, and that will keep you awake. If you're interested in debates on the Constitution and Bill of Rights, that's what the rest of the book is about. I hope you enjoy that part too. But I found in my career that most gun owners are very interested in protecting their rights, and you certainly don't have to be a lawyer to want to do that. That was the purpose of the Bill of Rights. St. George Tucker, who wrote the first commentaries on the Constitution, stated just that the Bill of Rights is not just for government officials to interpret, it's for the people to know so they can protect their rights and defend them from government. And finally, we have the Supreme Court saying that gee whiz, the right of the people to keep their arms means what it says. So, I haven't been watching the time too carefully, David. Am I okay? Okay. All right. time goes fast when you're up here. But after the first period of the revolution comes, and you don't see a lot of discussion about rights in the newspapers and journals of the time because they're busy fighting a war, but you do have the Patriots disarming the Tories and the Tories disarming the Patriots, and that's been something that detractors of the Second Amendment have seized upon recently to try to say, well, look, the founders believed in gun control because they seized guns from the Tories. People like Saul Cornell in his new book, A Well-Regulated Militia, makes that argument. And in fact, in some of the briefs in the early litigation in D.C., the Brady Center was bragging about in Maryland, at one point in colonial history, the Protestants disarmed the Catholics. And so that was a good precedent for gun control. So it shows that we have it in this country, and it should be here. And in fact, my favorite part of that litigation on that phase of it was D.C.'s argument in the Supreme Court bragging about it had a long tradition of gun control going back to the about 1851 or something. But the first D.C. gun law was depriving African Americans of firearms during slavery. Slavery was legal in D.C. until 1862. And the laws of Maryland applied there, and that was part of the slave code. And so if they wanted to brag about their long history of gun control in D.C., that's what it was. It was a total ban on firearms by black people. But in any case, these instances like the Patriots disarming the Tories, I mean, all is fair in love and war. And if you would kill somebody, then it would be like you're doing them a favor if you just disarm them instead and maybe imprison them. So that's what war is all about. And people are deprived of rights. Your enemies don't have free speech or anything like that. So we then get into the phase in 1776 when the first state constitutions are adopted, and some of them had bills of rights. And Pennsylvania was the first one to provide that recognition of the right of the people to bear arms in defense of themselves and the state. Now, that language has a curious history. Back in the 80s, when people like Don and myself were writing a lot of law review articles, and we point to language like that to show that the term bear arms can have different meanings, and it certainly can mean self-defense. The anti-Second Amendment scholars would say, well, when they said themselves and the state, they meant themselves collectively. There was no individual right to bear arms for themselves as individuals, but you could bear arms collectively to protect the state. Well, hello, doesn't the second part say bear arms in defense of themselves and the state? I mean, it already said state in the second part. So what do you mean that you can bear arms to defend the state in the first part? And, of course, look at what they meant by defend the state. It was against the established government. They were talking about defense from tyranny. They weren't saying that you had a right to bear arms to defend the state government of Pennsylvania. They're saying you can defend the state or the polity of Pennsylvania against the crown, against the established government. Vermont had the same language in 1777. North Carolina adopted a provision, the right of the people to bear arms in defense of the state. Massachusetts added to keep arms. The people have a right to keep and bear arms for the common defense. Now, another one of those real winners at the oral argument in March had to do with those provisions. Justice Stevens asked the counsel for Mr. Heller, wasn't it the case that only two states had individual rights arms guarantees and all the rest were collective? Well, first of all, there were only a total of four bearing arms guarantees at that time. Right, two of them were clearly individual, defense of themselves and the state. But then there were only two others. So what do you mean all the rest of them? And what did they say? They both recognized the right as being in the people. The right to bear arms in defense of the state, for example, that meant you would be able to have the arms and to bear them in defense of the state. It didn't mean, though, that the overall government could tell you whether you could have arms at all. And in fact, it was interpreted at the time to mean an individual right. So that's an example of some of the fun and games that go on in the court. You get a question like that that's totally off the wall, and you got to be quick-footed to sometimes to answer those questions. But when we move on into the period of we won the Revolution, the Constitution gets proposed, it has no Bill of Rights, that upset a few people. It gets debated. People like Madison and Hamilton say in the Federalist Papers, you don't need a Bill of Rights. For a couple of reasons. First of all, anything you don't put on there, they'll say you don't have that as a right. And also, even the things that you have protected, there'll be artful misconstruction to turn that wording against you. Hello, that's what happened with the Second Amendment, right? Just because we've got that nice militia clause in there, then they say that obliterates the substantive guarantee. But the better argument was it's best to list the rights if you can, to the extent you can, and that way people remember them. And in fact, we go through three phases when the Constitution gets adopted as regards the Bill of Rights. In the first phase, we have the Federalists winning in every convention, getting it ratified with no Bill of Rights, but people like Samuel Adams in the Massachusetts Convention or the dissent of the minority in the Pennsylvania Convention, and then finally New Hampshire as a convention recommends a Bill of Rights. So, but the first states in that first period adopt the Constitution and with no mandatory recommendation of a Bill of Rights. And that changed when Virginia ratified the Constitution. There was a lot of debate between people like Patrick Henry saying that the great object is that every man be armed, and George Mason saying that they can disarm the people, they can disarm the militia if you don't have guarantees. You have a compromise where Madison agreed with the other Federalists to recommend a Bill of Rights when the first Federal Congress would meet. And all the rest of the states, when they ratified, they had the same provision that basically, we're ratifying the Constitution, but we want a Bill of Rights. We want to have free speech and the right to bear arms and the right for assemble clearly stated. And Madison gets up and on June the 8th of 1789, the first federal Congress, and proposes the Bill of Rights. Tench Cox, a famous Federalist writer, said that that was to prevent tyranny of a standing army, and that you would have a right to keep and bear your private arms. That was not contested, but that explanation was widely published throughout the colonies. And if I can just stop there for just a second to show you what happens with scholarship or lack thereof. We've been using that Tench Cox for many years. It was the most important contemporaneous explanation of what Madison said. It was published just 10 days after the Bill of Rights was proposed. So fast forward to the year 2000, there's an entire law review issue devoted to the collective rights view and paid for by the Joyce Foundation. And we have Jack Rakoff, the scholar from Stanford, saying that, well, Tench Cox didn't know what he was talking about, and that although nobody disagreed with it, that's because they weren't interested in the Bill of Rights, and that, you know, one thing or another to distract from what he said. And you can put that with a whole lot of other quotes from the founders on the meaning of the Second Amendment. You know, Patrick Henry, that every man be armed, quotes like that. And they say, and the anti-Second Amendment scholars say, well, they didn't say those things very much. They said a whole lot more about a militia. And guess what they didn't say anything about, though? The collective rights view, I mean, that was never once enunciated in that period. And there's a couple of sentences I wrote in that every man be armed, and I think got more mileage than anything else in the book, like, or maybe one sentence, that if anybody had the collective rights view when the founders adopted the Constitution and Bill of Rights, it's one of the closest guarded secrets of the 18th century, because nobody's found it yet. And that I stick with that today. That was first published in 1984. But with all this litigation we've been through and all the generation of anti-Second Amendment literature by numerous historians and law professors, there's never once been anybody identified who held this so-called collective rights view at the time of the founding. So that's basically what's in the book. I've got some material on the Militia Act of 1792, very interesting debates on that, where Roger Sherman of Connecticut says things like there's an individual right to self-defense and states have a right to defend themselves. And basically that was the founders' thought. There's nothing contradictory between the clauses of the Second Amendment. Individual right to keep and bear arms made a militia possible. It was not that somehow if you allowed the right to bear arms to be recognized as an individual right, then you couldn't have a militia. It's just the opposite of that. And the last part of the book has to do with the founders and their twilight years. They're starting to die off. You know, Jefferson and Adams died on the same date, July the 4th in 1824. Jefferson was a big gun collector. He collected fine guns, fine wines, and fine books. He went on shopping sprees in Paris and London when he was over there. And some of his guns survive to this day, including pocket pistols and long guns, and he was a big hunter. I don't think John Adams was much of a hunter or an athlete of any kind, but he did own pistols. All of the founders did. And then you have the feigned view invented by the so-called modern scholars that the founders hated guns. Well, this is the Michael Belisle's theory. The founders hated guns. Their guns didn't work very good. They did more trapping than hunting. And when they died, there were no guns in their inventories. And, of course, he fabricated the inventory counts. So, but when the book was published, all of you remember this probably, the book Arming America, all the Jack Rakoffs and Gary Wills and all that crowd fell all over themselves praising the book by Mr. Belisle, who was later disowned of his the Bancroft Prize, and what a scandal that was. So that's the book. I hope you enjoy it, and I hope you enjoy life in the post-Heller epoch that we've now entered. And probably I'll sit down now and turn it over back to David and let Don have a go at it.